seated, please.
Court is ready to hear argument in 040692, Guide One Elite Insurance Company versus Field of Road Baptist Church.
May it please the court, I, along with co-counsel Grant Oster, represent Guide One Elite Insurance, the petitioner in this matter. Based upon the number of briefs that have been filed by other parties, there's clearly some far-reaching implications on what this court decides. But that's not my job here. My job here is to represent my client, so I am going to try to focus on the actual case that's before this court and the facts that were raised and the evidence that we have. And I believe, Your Honor, if you look at the specific facts that you have before you, you will see that it is almost unconscionable that two parties to a contract, an insurance contract, and stipulate that there is essentially no coverage and have the trial court not be allowed to consider that stipulation. Now, I recognize that it's a very unusual situation we have before us, that we have a sophisticated insured who was represented at all times executing a stipulation that essentially established no coverage. But we believe under those facts that should be considered. If the court looks at the pleadings below, specifically the Jane Doe pleadings, the court will see that Jane Doe sued the church almost solely for vicarious liability causes of action based upon the acts of Mr. Evans. Jane Doe specifically stated that all of the acts occurred while Mr. Evans was a youth minister. There were very few causes of action. In fact, I'm not sure there were any that would not have arisen while Mr. Evans was a youth minister, or arguably perhaps before he was a youth minister, because there are a few allegations about the church not providing warnings.
So let's say that we agree that assertion was groundless, false, or fraudulent. Okay, it should not have been in the pleading, but it was. The policy says we have the right and duty to investigate any claim and to defend any suit brought against you seeking damages, even if the allegations are groundless, false, or fraudulent.
I agree, Your Honor, but however, you need to look at the entire policy language. The church has constantly used that three-word phrase that's at the end of the paragraph that is the insuring agreement. And in this particular policy, there are two insuring agreements that you have to look at. One's under the sexual misconduct, and one is under the general liability. In both, in the paragraph that deals with the duty to defend, the policy starts with language that says, in the CGL portion, to which this policy applies. And in the sexual misconduct, the paragraph says, which occurs during the policy period. The contract, the policy, continues to go on and state that we will defend even if it's groundless, false, or fraudulent. You can't take that sentence out of the entire policy. And besides, there are a number of cases who have addressed that particular language. In every single case, the McLaren case, the Cook case, the Wade case, they have all stated that the phrase groundless, false, and fraudulent goes to the merits of the plaintiff's case, not whether it's covered. In other words, I can't get up here and say, Mr. Evans never did this, the church has no liability, and therefore I have no duty to defend. But I can say there's no coverage. The church argues that groundless means even if it's not covered, I still have to defend. And yet the church has brought you absolutely no case that has said that a non-covered suit is considered groundless and there's a duty to defend. So I would suggest respectively, Your Honor, that the groundless phrase deals only with the merits and not with the coverage. And because the stipulation...
How do you separate those, though? I mean, if he was not employed as a youth minister, and therefore the suit against the church was groundless, I mean, why is that not covered by that provision?
Actually, Your Honor, I believe that would be. One of the amicus briefs that was filed at the very end, in fact, I think filed yesterday, suggested an example where they said, what if the milk was never delivered, the tainted milk was never delivered to the school, or what if the tainted milk was delivered before the policy went into effect? Unfortunately, the way the court has addressed merits and coverage, the first one goes to the merits. If the church says, I don't know who Mr. Evans is, then unfortunately that's the merits, and I would owe a duty to defend. But when it's a coverage situation, which I know sounds absurd, but unfortunately that's the way the court has addressed coverage and merits. When it goes to coverage,
but it goes to merits. It goes to merits as well, though, doesn't it?
Well, not in this particular case, Your Honor, because in this case, Fielder Rhodes stipulated that he was a youth minister. He was a volunteer. He was a member of their church for a time period covered by the plaintiff's pleadings. There was never an allegation that the church didn't have liability, at least not in the declaratory judgment action. The allegation was, and the church admitted it or stipulated to it, that nothing that they could have done happened during the Guideline policy period.
Did you file special exceptions?
Pardon me?
Did you file special exceptions?
Certainly not to the underlying suit, Your Honor.
Wouldn't that have fixed the problem? If they say it was O.J. that did it, and O.J. was an employee of the church, then the problem is, under Rule 11 in the Civil Practice Remedies Code, that's totally groundless, and the attorney gets sanctioned. The attorney pays for whatever money your insurer has to. So if a plaintiff tries to get around that by saying a football player did it and refuses to say who it is, then you file special exceptions, you flush them out, and you make the attorney, at the risk of their own sanctionability, say specifically who we're saying did it and when we're saying it occurred, and then you can get off under the eight corners rule.
I agree.
So why didn't you do it that way?
Well, because, Your Honor, you raise a very excellent point. God One is not a party to the underlying suit. And the attorney that we hire to defend Fielder Road until the declaratory judgment can't do anything that might harm their coverage. So if Ms. Doe had alleged that on December 2nd, December 24th, February 3rd, Mr. Evans committed these acts, we wouldn't be here. All she had to do was allege when the acts occurred. We would know whether they were in or outside of the policy, and we wouldn't be here. And my attorney, or their attorney that I hire, can't do anything that's going to hurt them in the underlying suit, so I don't have that right. I have to do what we did here, which is what insurance carriers have been doing for years. We defended under a reservation of rights. We filed a declaratory judgment. We obtained a stipulation because Fielder Road did not want to subject themselves to a deposition. The judge ruled on the declaratory judgment, said no duty to defend, and we withdrew the defense. Now, one thing I would like to point out, Your Honor, we were provided with an exhibit this morning, which I assume the church will attempt to use in their argument. For the first time, based upon that exhibit, it appears that Fielder Road is going to argue that plaintiff's allegations are not based upon Mr. Evans' dates of employment as a youth minister. If you look at all of the pleadings in the record, the case has always been the dates are 92 to 94 or 92 to 93, and it's whether or not that stipulation is applicable. So I would urge, Your Honor, that the exhibit, as far as they're trying to raise new arguments, shouldn't be allowed.
Do we have to overrule Hayden in your analysis?
No, I don't believe we do, Your Honor. I believe Hayden and Tri-Coastal, a petition denied by this court in 1998, affirmed that the purpose of the eight corners rule is to not allow an insurer to go to the merits of the plaintiff's case. I believe that is true today, and I don't believe that's what Guideline is doing. But there are a number of cases, unfortunately mostly they are United States District Court cases out of the Northern District or the Fifth Circuit, that say when you're dealing with coverage, whether there's coverage under a policy, you can go to extrinsic evidence. You should not allow a plaintiff to create coverage. If you look at Judge McBride's opinions, and me being from Fort Worth, I get to read his opinions quite a bit, he is very adamant, but he makes very good points. In the Western Heritage case, they first argued that the defendant was intoxicated, and of course coverage was denied. So the plaintiff got smart and said he was not intoxicated, he was impaired. And then, of course, they argued that there was a duty to defend. And Judge McBride said that you cannot create coverage by changing the facts. And that's why he believed, both in that case and the Blue Ridge case, that you have to look at the true facts to determine coverage. But you can't go behind the pleadings to say whether there's liability.
What happens during the the coverage issue can't be determined. You're defending this case on a reservation of rights. The claim is meritless, but nonetheless you have a duty to defend based on the first information that you have and the information you have during up to the first couple of weeks of trial. But then at trial, you find that the occurrence is outside the policy period. Do you shut down your defense there and let the insurer go on defending itself? And what do you do in that scenario?
Well, obviously, Your Honor, you're asking me for a little speculation, but I would think in those facts that we should continue with the law that we have now, which is you cannot change your position on duty to defend as facts are developed throughout the lawsuit. I believe one of the two amicus briefs filed, they either a merits or complex claims, talked about facts that are readily ascertainable ought to be allowed to determine coverage. And I think in most of the commentators on this issue, they discuss that if it's apparent from the face of the pleadings that there's no coverage, the insurance carrier can determine from the onset there's no duty to defend. If it's not clear, then the carrier should do what Guide 1 did, file a declaratory judgment action, have readily ascertainable facts that deal with coverage, have a determination made. If Guide 1 loses, they defend through the end.
What about the policy argument that to do that would undermine the insured's ability, perhaps undermine the insured's ability to defend itself in the underlying litigation?
One of the suggestions made in one of the amicus briefs, I think, is very well taken, and that is the only evidence that you could use in a declaratory judgment would be evidence that's discoverable in the case below. I frankly do not believe that an insured would actually testify one way in a coverage case and then testify another in the other case, because one's going to be a lie and he ought to be under oath both times. But if there's something that the insurance carrier is entitled to get from the insured that the plaintiff is not, then I think that perhaps that evidence ought to be limited, because that could harm the insured, because now suddenly there's evidence that's out there that the insured, that plaintiff would have never gotten in the underlying case. So I think that's a limitation that perhaps should be considered to keep that harm from happening. Your Honor, stipulations have been used in numerous cases, the Bowl case, in the Cook case, and in Western Heritage, to go outside of the eight corners rule. And I believe that it should be done here, too. And I further would suggest, Your Honors, that even with the exceptions that have been recognized by the Courts of Appeal, and I recognize that this Court has never actually written on any exception to the eight corners rule, this Court has, to some extent, given us some guidance on earlier opinions. For example, I think it's very instructive to look at the Cook case, which was written in 67, and I believe by the Texarkana Court. And they analyzed the two opinions issued by this court in 1965, when none of us were obviously doing what we're doing. And the court said if you compare Hayden and Bowl was a case where it was NRE, and Hayden, of course, was an opinion of the Texas Supreme Court. It was clear that extrinsic evidence that went to the merits, the Hayden case, is not admissible. In the Bowl case, they allowed extrinsic evidence that went to coverage to show that there was no coverage under the policy. And the 65 court said NRE, which is not exactly agreeing with it, but it still gives us guidance that with the facts, the extrinsic evidence go to coverage, they should be allowed, and I believe the court should do that here. And the courts of appeals have acknowledged other exceptions that this stipulation falls within. And the biggest that's never really been disputed is when the plaintiff's pleadings are insufficient to tell us whether or not there is coverage. And in this case, the plaintiff alleged approximately 1992 to 1994. Was that intentional? I don't know. I would assume Ms. Doe knew when the bad acts occurred and she could have given us specific dates. She chose not to. But when she says approximately 1992 to 1994, and my policy goes into effect in March 31st of 93, I can't decide coverage. So in the exception that's been recognized by a number of courts of appeals, which I think should be continued, if you can't tell from the pleadings, you're allowed to look at extrinsic evidence like this stipulation. And lastly, Your Honors, I believe that the pleadings from the Jane Doe petition...
What if it turns out the stipulation is wrong? Church was mistaken.
For one, Your Honor, to some extent, we've had declaratory judgments deciding coverage for a long time. And there's always the chance that there's going to be a wrong decision below. I frankly always think that if I've got two litigants who are fighting the same thing and I've got a fact finder who's looking at only one issue, coverage, that's when you're most likely to get the right decision. In this situation, I believe the stipulation falls within a readily ascertainable fact, and so the dates of employment. And so therefore, I think it should be accepted. May I continue just briefly, Your Honor? I think I have 5 more minutes.
Are there I mean, you can take some of your rebuttal time.
Is that all right, Your Honor? Yes. Just briefly, because I did not address bodily injury, and I don't think it's fair to fill the road to not address it, if they'd like to respond. And I would just like to point out, Your Honors, that Cohen made it clear that bodily injury requires damage or harm to the body. What Ms. Doe did below is exactly what Judge McBride warns against in Western. She never alleged bodily injury, never alleged it. It was all mental until we filed our summary judgment. She amends her pleadings, and all she states is that she suffered bodily injury. That's a factual allegation. Excuse me, that's a legal allegation, not a factual allegation. She has never once alleged that there was any harm or damage to her body. She alleges she had mental problems, she required counseling, and those type of issues. Cowan made it clear that those do not trigger coverage on a policy that requires bodily injury. Thank you.
Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
Please report, Mr. Randy Rose, to present argument from the respondent. May it please the court. This case is of very substantial importance to all policyholders in the state of Texas. If you agree with the proposals that have been made both by this insurance company and by their amicus, which is the insurance industry, AIG Travelers, the entire insurance industry cares deeply about this issue for one reason. It will save insurers massive amounts of duty to defend money. If they can establish if this court will do something that is radical, a sea change, a revolution in duty to defend law, and say there will no longer be a duty to defend unless the claims against the defendant are true. Groundless, false, and fraudulent claims will no longer be defended in this state.
Now, I read that to mean claims on the merits, and that you have to read the policy in toto. And if all these things happen in the context of environmental laws, you determine that the occurrence happened outside the policy period, there's no coverage, whether you litigate it before or after. If the occurrence is outside the policy period, the policy doesn't apply.
There's a couple problems with that, Your Honor. The first is that presupposes there's only one type of coverage. Not, as is the case, two different types of coverage in any policy. There's a duty to defend that is separate and distinct.
And it's broader than a duty to indemnify. We know all that.
No. But even more than that, has a completely different basis for deciding whether that coverage is triggered. And that is triggered purely by what the allegations are. False, true, groundless, or fraudulent.
Why isn't it triggered by the date of occurrence?
The date of occurrence, Your Honor, is a coverage issue, but that's not the issue here. The issue here is whether there's no question that there was an occurrence in this case. They don't challenge that. We don't challenge that. Okay? The only question here is whether these claims against the church, whether they are vicarious liability based on him being an employee, or other claims that are direct claims against the church and don't have anything to do with whether he was an employee, whether the entire lawsuit no longer gets a duty to defend.
But doesn't it matter when the occurrence happened? I mean, if it was 10 years ago, 10 years before the policy was written, certainly there would be no duty to defend.
Again, Ron, that's not argued here. In this case, there was an occurrence in 92, 93, and 94. The plaintiff alleges there was sexual misconduct committed by Mr. Evans in 92 and 93 and 94. That's why no one argues there wasn't any occurrence. Their argument says, I have a stipulation, and it says Mr. Evans was not an employee after December 1992. So for our policy period, 93 and 94, he wasn't an employee, and therefore, there's no coverage. Now, that's just absolutely untrue. Okay? That argument that he was not an employee goes to whether or not the church can be vicariously liable on a respondeat superior theory in 93 and 94. That's all that goes to. It does not go to whether the church is an insured. There's never been any argument that the church, by this policy, is an insured if there were sexual misconduct occurring during their policy period. These allegations are absolutely clear.
But if there weren't?
If
there weren't sexual occurrences during the policy period, then what?
Well, of course, now this stipulation doesn't go to that.
But if there weren't, I mean, you say
yes.
We're going to get past the eight corners rule, but the more troublesome thing is, are there just no circumstances no matter how clearly it is that there's no coverage, that we're not going to look past the eight corners rule.
That is the big issue, absolutely. And that's where Hayden comes in and where Argonaut comes in. And yes, Your Honor, and I know that it is tempting to say, to conflate the duty to indemnify issue, whether the allegations are true, whether or not the occurrence actually did occur in 1993-94, with the duty to defend. But that is absolutely contrary to both the insurance contract here and to this court's holdings for 65 years, well, for 40 years.
But if we have this case, but if the stipulation were that he was not employed during the policy period, he was gone and a stranger to the church.
Yes.
But nevertheless, there were pleadings that was not the case. You say duty to defend.
If the petition alleges that they did occur during that period of time, then yes, the duty to defend. That's always in the law. Now, your question goes, why shouldn't we change the law? I assume. Because there are commentators who have said that. The insurance industry would save a lot of money if that were the case. Here's a reason why we shouldn't do that. Apart from this particular contract language and the fact that you would be doing something this court has never done before, which is to ignore an express agreement between the parties, I can think of no other context in which this court has ever said, we think it's appropriate to rewrite the policy. Take this agreement out and ignore it. Never done that before. Overturning stare decisis, engaging in judicial activism, not something this court has ever embraced before.
Judicial activism?
Absolutely.
This is an area of the common law, isn't it?
It is.
There's no statute or governing constitutional provision.
Right, but there is a contract. Absolutely, there is a contract between these two parties, and it says all allegations, groundless, false, or fraudulent, will be defended. You're going to write this out of the contract if you adopt this view that if the allegations are actually groundless, false, or fraudulent, the contrary, we won't defend you.
What's the history of that language? Where did it come from? Why is it in a policy?
Your Honor, I know that it was in the policy for a long time. I can't say how far back in history it goes.
Why is it there?
It is there, yes. It is there because when you're a defendant and you've paid for duty to defend coverage, the plaintiff gets to go forward against you on those allegations. Whether the insurance company provides you a defense or not, you're going to have to defend that. So the whole concept was, if you're going to pay premium dollars to get a defense, you ought to get what you paid for. So, and the truth is, many or most lawsuits against defendants are probably not true. Okay? You deserve a defense even more so where you did not commit the wrong, where you are not a tortfeasor, where you do not owe damages. You should have a defense paid for by the insurance company you paid all those premium dollars to for defense coverage as well as for indemnity. This court has acknowledged that the defense obligation is the more expansive and it's the more expensive. Your Honor, Justice Heck, you've written that before. And it's the most important to defendants because you're always going to be having to defend yourself. You may not have to pay any money. You may not be a judgment debtor at the end of the trial, but you will always have to be a defendant defending yourself.
What if there's collusion? Is your position the same? Collusion in order to obtain defense and a coverage between the parties in the underlying suit.
Yeah, I'm not here to sanction collusion. I'm not here to say it happens all the time or it never happens, neither of those. But yes, Your Honor, that's our position. In those rare instances when it does happen, the overriding importance to policyholders to get what they paid for, a defense, applies.
Is it a crime to knowingly allege false statements in a civil action?
I don't know if it's a crime, but it's absolutely contrary to our rules, Your Honor.
Is it a crime to make false statements in an open court, in open court to a judge, and put those in writing?
I know that's sanctionable. I do not know if it's criminal.
Does your position change?
Absolutely not.
So the contract should, if there's a collusive crime being committed, the contract should even trump the criminal law.
I guess I don't understand the collusion aspect. The plaintiff signs the pleadings that are false and criminal.
Well, the collusive aspect could come in, and I know it's not this case. I'm trying to understand how far your rule is going to take us. how far your argument is going to take us, because as you recognize, we're not just deciding this case, trying to do justice here, but we've got to think about its implications. If there's collusion between the parties in the underlying lawsuit in a bad set of circumstances where they agree that we're going to, the plaintiff says we're going to write some allegations that are going to get a defense for you, and the insured says, well, I'm going to do everything I can, even if it's false, making false representations to get coverage so that we can both get out of this with a benefit. And assume doing that in an open court, making false allegations knowingly, is a crime, then the insured is still entitled to a defense under those circumstances.
Yes, because there are two different issues. Prosecute the crime, but do not make a rule that is based around an exception that is criminal, that is improper, and that we do not suppose or presume occurred. If it did occur, prosecute them. Prosecute them in the full extent of the law. But let's not create a rule around something that, frankly, this court's never seen.
Let me give you another example. Sure. Defendant doesn't have car insurance for 2000, but does have a policy for 2001. There's a wreck in 2000. Plaintiff finds this out, so the plaintiff simply alleges that the wreck took place in 2001.
Sure.
Who, and so, now, we all know that's not true. We all know they're uninsured, but the plaintiff's certainly not going to assert it because they want to at least get some settlement value because you're going to have to pay this defense attorney to defend the whole case. The defendant's not going to allege it, so nobody's going to say anything about it. And even though we all know there was no coverage, we're going to act like there was, and all the policyholders for a defendant insurance company are going to subsidize this suit.
Well, for the defense dollars, yes. For the indemnity, obviously, no. There will be no payment.
Right.
The insurance company can say,
no,
sorry.
I understand.
Sure. But yes, for defense. And that's because the insurance industry, for time immemorial, has known that that occurs. And this is not a revelation. This is not something that's a secret to them. They budget that.
They were doing that back in 1965?
Absolutely. Maybe back in 1945.
Perhaps. Not you personally, of course.
But those kind of, I mean, yes, there are certainly situations that really pain us to say, why should we assume, why should there be the assumption of coverage when we know it's not true? And the truth is because you have to separate out these two different types of coverages.
Is there any other way to make that happen? So, for example, can you push a coverage dispute that's clear? And I realize some of them aren't clear. But if you do have a clear out on coverage, can you get findings of fact and conclusions of law as an evidentiary matter in that proceeding?
In the deck action?
Yes. And would those, how would that affect the defense of the underlying suit?
I guess I'm not sure what exactly happens in the deck action. In your scenario, is there a finding of
when the car wreck occurred?
Yeah, I mean, you have a trial, and a quick trial, and the trial court finds, I find, as an evidentiary matter, that the wreck happened on X date. Mm-hmm. And does that then bind?
The plaintiff probably not.
Of course not. Because the plaintiff wasn't a party. And that's the secret vice here. Your Honors, I know when we talk about the hypotheticals and we're supposed to assume the truth, but that's great for here, but that's not the way the real world works because we don't know what the truth is. All we know is that the plaintiff has alleged X, Y, and Z. Here the plaintiff alleges there was sexual misconduct every year, 92, 93, 94.
Well, she alleges a little more than that. She alleges he's an employee from 92 to 94.
Two separate deals. Two separate sexual misconduct by Evans, 92, 93, 94. Separate and apart from the employee status, Your Honor, that those sexual misconducts occur. Okay? The church is being sued for direct responsibility for failing to warn, for not stopping the sexual conduct, for breaching fiduciary duties, etc. Knowing that the allegations of the plaintiff are the church knew that that conduct was going on at all times, did not stop it, did not warn it, and that theory directly against the church makes them liable, if proved, is completely independent of whether or not he was no longer an employee in 93 and 94. Even on the vicarious liability issue, Your Honor, they pled apparent agency. He can stop this stipulation even if it were accepted. could be accepted as true so that Mr. Evans is no longer an employee in 93 and 94. That still leaves the allegations, which we have to assume is true under common law and under the contract, that he was an employee in 92 for that period of time. The allegations say he developed this relationship with the young girl and that that allowed him to commit these terrible things. It alleges that she believes, they all believe, that he was an employee during all that time. You have just made out an apparent agency theory that even though he wasn't an employee, she thought he was still an employee in 93-94, their policy period, when the sexual misconduct occurred. So even the employee's non-employee stipulation does not get them out of having to defend this case. I don't have to tell this court that all I have to do is have one allegation that is potentially covered, and they have a duty to defend. I've just given you a vicarious liability theory that's not responding out superior, and I've given you all these direct theories of liability. So for this case, it's a really simple one. They had to defend us under those allegations.
It's not clear to me on the more academic point of the eight corners rule and possible exceptions to it. What consensus there is in the American jurisdictions? Can you shed any light on that?
Well, I would say that the American states are all over the board on this issue, true. There are some states that only provide extrinsic evidence to prove a duty to defend. There are some states that allow both proving a duty to defend and not proving a duty to defend. I wouldn't say we are in the majority, but we are one of a number of states who have been viewed as being a strict eight corners jurisdiction. I favor the Northfield approach, Your Honor. I truly believe that for lots of practical reasons, the strict eight corners rule is the best rule. But clearly, exceptions are committed in other jurisdictions. Exceptions could be committed here. And the Northfield approach makes an awful lot of sense. Very, very narrow, going only to the issue of coverage.
What exceptions would you make? A minute ago, you wouldn't make an exception for commission of a crime. So what other exceptions are there?
Your Honor, I don't think anything related to the merits. Oh, I'm sorry. You're talking about the commission of crime of fraudulence.
In my example, my hypothesis.
Right. Well, you know, why would you?
So, if a crime doesn't create a sufficient basis for an exception for you, what does? You just, I think, just now said there could be some exceptions. What would they be that are appropriate in your mind?
I'm basically adopting the Fifth Circuit's approach in Northfield. I'm saying, number one, if there are insufficient facts in the pleadings to tell whether you're inside or outside of coverage, not this case, and certainly not this case with respect to groundless, false, or fraudulent. Okay?
But it doesn't say criminal in that list, groundless, false, or fraudulent.
Your Honor, if you make a criminal exception, you know, we'll live with it.
No, I'm trying to figure out the contours of your position. How far does it reach? You got my attention just a minute ago when you said there may be exceptions.
Right.
I'm trying to figure out what they are in your mind.
Here's my conclusion. Number one, the facts in the pleadings have to be insufficient. Number two, the extrinsic evidence should only go to a pure coverage issue if the evidence, extrinsic evidence, goes to an overlapping coverage and merits issue, not acceptable, and because of the potential prejudice and compromise of the insured's defense below. I believe that there should be an automatic abatement of the deck action if there is a claim that it does go to the merits of the case. If the insured says, look, this extrinsic evidence and discovery on this extrinsic evidence puts me at risk in the underlying case because I have to be proven something that's bad for me in the liability case in order to get defense, okay, that shouldn't be proven. Next, there ought to be a defense in the coverage case paid for by the insurance company. Okay, independent counsel should be provided so that the insured does not have to pay for the defense of that action, the extrinsic evidence of that action. They've already paid their premium dollars for defense. If this court says we have concerns about cases going forward that shouldn't go forward, then because we paid the premium dollars, we should get at least not having to pay for it out of our own pocket.
Is there any other state that requires that?
I believe there is. I can't promise you this, but I believe California may provide.
Does the name Kumis come to mind?
Yes, California. California. So, again, Your Honor, I would divide the world. I would not permit any extrinsic evidence exception if the allegation is groundless, false, or fraudulent. If that's the species of coverage problem that the insurance company is raising, it would only be where there is nothing said. And let me hasten to say that this will work for policyholders just as well as it will work for insurers. There are many cases, Your Honor, where maybe it was a crime that the plaintiff did not put into their pleading the exposure dates that would be necessary for the policyholder to trigger a defense in a particular year. The Fifth Circuit case called Azron that said because the plaintiff's allegations is completely silent as to when the pollution or dumping occurred, the petition is insufficient to put the insurance company for this particular year on the book. If we adopt an exception rule, the policyholder will now be able to go forward and generate extrinsic evidence that the pollution event occurred in a particular year. Policyholders would love that. That's why, as long as there is an even-handed approach to exceptions, that's fine. The truth is that the only party that loses is the policyholder if they have to come out of their own pocket to pay for their prosecution or defense of this declaratory judgment extrinsic evidence case.
Are there any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor.
Mr. Lasker, you noted at the end of your initial presentation that plaintiffs never alleged bodily injury. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. Until the third amended petition, and then in her factual allegations, all she stated was Jane Doe suffered bodily injury, period.
Well, why isn't that sufficient? Certainly the parties are entitled to plead and replead and sometimes plead themselves into coverage.
Right, I agree. I understand that's one of the things that they did. But the SciTech engineering case talks about that when you're looking at coverage, you look at factual allegations, not legal conclusions. Bodily injury is a legal term. When you look
it's
at
not actual, mixed. It's a legal issue.
It's probably mixed. But if you look at her actual allegation, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, go ahead.
She then goes on in her damages, and she talks about exactly what she suffered. And she talks about mental anguish, needing counseling, depression, and never once is there any allegation that she had any pain, bruising, tearing, anything.
But there's no assertion of sexual assault or abuse or exploitation or...
There was no assertion of sexual assault or abuse. In this case, Your Honor, I believe Ms. Doe is a teenager. And obviously the way that the policy is written, it requires bodily injury excluding sickness and disease because I believe it's the intent of Guide 1 to not cover for consensual sex. There has to be an actual bodily injury. And Cohen has determined that bodily injury requires harm or damage, not just because you're upset about it. I would say that Ms. Doe's just one statement, I suffered bodily injury, without more is not enough to meet Cohen. And, Your Honor, one of the things that Fielder Road brought up, which I believe is important, is the Eight Corners Rule works both ways. It's not just an insurance industry that wants this. It's the insurers, too. All of you have been trial lawyers. I can tell you that I have many cases where it goes both ways. The insurance company denies a defense because the pleadings don't have facts that trigger coverage, even though everyone knows that there's really coverage. So it's important for both insurers and insurers that this situation be clarified. And I believe it's important, and I believe several of you mentioned this, I agree that when you pay for a policy, you're entitled to a defense, whether you did something wrong or not.
So you're saying if the petition does not allege an obvious fact that for which there'd be coverage, then what, the plaintiff can file a deck action and say, you know, the extrinsic evidence is that this petition is really talking about an incident that occurred within the policy.
I believe this should go both ways. I don't see why it should be any other. And I agree that they're entitled to a defense if it's in the policy. Justice, I believe you stated, what happens if the accident happened 10 years before the policy? What if everybody, we know the accident happened in 2000, but the policy was in 2001? A coverage holder is entitled to a defense, but only if there's coverage. And Fielder Road has still not cited one case that tells you that groundless, false, and fraudulent applies to cases for which there are no coverage. Professor Dahomey, in her treatise, I believe written in the early 80s, discussed that that language changed in most insurance policies once Hayden was decided, and they started adding in different language. Now, Professor Dahomey stated in the 80s that she believed the language still meant that the duty to defend was broader than the duty to indemnify. Judge McBride in the McLaurin's case out of the Northern District stated that with the present-day language in policies, and the language he interpreted was very, very similar to the Guide 1 policy, he felt like the duty to defend was no broader than the duty to indemnify. And if you look at the policy, everything that Fielder Road keeps telling you is they take three words out of the end of a paragraph. And if you will look at my brief beginning at the bottom of page 15 and through 16, I set forth both provisions in their entirety. And both provisions require that it occur either within the policy period or that the policy covers it. And there's nothing that's been presented to you that by the sheer fact it says groundless, false, and fraudulent, I somehow have to defend something that's not covered. And again, Your Honor, we have a stipulation. It's a contract between Guide 1 and Fielder Road Baptist Church. They stipulated that there was no coverage, essentially, by stipulating that Mr. Evans ceased to be a youth minister, ceased to have any role with the church before the Guide 1 policy went into effect. And for the first time, excuse me, Your Honor, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes this argument and all arguments for this morning, and the marshal will now adjourn the court.